Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
And I am Dave, your host. And everything is messed up. And everything's okay, maybe, I don't know. I guess that's what today's talk is about. Everything is messed up and everything is okay. This is Lodro Rinzler, regular contributor to the podcast. He is the author of several books, including The Buddha Walks Into a Bar, Walk Like a Buddha, and most recently, Love Hurts, Buddhist Advice for the Heartbroken. This was a talk recorded fairly recently, actually just earlier this month. So it is fairly, let's just say, topical. Seems like time is moving rapidly these days, but I think it still applies, this talk. But before we get to this, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a weekton. What's a weekton? It's a technical term. I guess. It means a week of meditation. It means a 7-day meditation retreat. And it's happening at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. So you don't have to go off into the snow-capped mountains or into a cave. No! You can go to 22nd Street every day for a week and meditate in a retreat-like atmosphere. This is a retreat that's happening the week of February 20th, and it's being led by Acharya Richard John, himself a very experienced retreatant and senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. So for more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org and look on the homepage for Winter Weekton. Again, that's a meditation retreat with Acharya Richard John beginning February 20th. And now, Lodro, what's going on? Are we going to make it? Is everything okay? Really? Really?
The idea here, and particularly this week, where things feel messy, things feel stressful, there's a lot of fear, for sure, a lot of concern, a lot of worry. And then there's this idea that we're also okay. In the Shambhala Buddhist tradition, we have a very interesting term that we throw around, and it's called basic goodness. Basic isn't like simplistic. It's not like easy. It's actually meant to be, another way we could talk about it is foundational. Basic is inherent or innate to who we are. That's what we mean by the word basic. And goodness, another way that we could think of goodness, is not good versus bad, not like light versus evil. It's not that sense of dualism at all. It's actually more a sense of wholeness, completeness, awake. The idea that we are inherently strong, kind, good, peaceful. That's our birthright, that's who we are. That's what we mean when we use this term, basic goodness. So when I say I'm also okay, what I mean is inherently I'm okay. Inherently I'm basically good. And I think if you've even had just a slight glimmer while you're meditating, where you are actually able to relax for a second and not realize how much you've overbooked yourself, or realize how much emails are in your inbox, or how much you need to break up with or get back together with that ex. That moment when you actually drop into feeling the breath, not thinking about the breath, but feeling the breath, relaxing into the present moment, you might say, huh, things are fundamentally okay. In this moment, if I'm present for it, I'm okay. That's interesting news that we can use. So this is on the individual level. We have this idea that maybe we have to balance these two things. The very notion and ideally experience of basic goodness, So it's not just a theoretical thing that Lodra Rinsler tossed out at you and you have to accept by all means. Going back to the very beginning of this, the idea of true and the story of the Buddha being asked to teach, that if this doesn't mesh with your experience, and don't take it at face value. But ideally, if you haven't already, at some point you might experience a sense of wholeness, completeness. Awake. If even for a second, a millisecond. So that you could then have faith or trust in your own experience of basic goodness, as opposed to my theoretical thing that I'm talking to you about that may or may not land in your own experience. So we balance this. The Buddhists will often talk about Tathagatagarbha, which can be translated as Buddha nature, the idea that we're inherently awake, enlightened, and then also we don't walk around like that, we act pretty confused. We perpetuate our own suffering. So coming out of the Buddhist tradition, we often talk about it in this context. You might know something about the Four Noble Truths, where we talk a lot about how we perpetuate our own suffering through craving and ignorance. But the good news truth, the third truth, is always that we actually could stop and rest in our sense of wholeness and completeness and awake. How do we do that? The path of mindfulness and compassion. How do we cultivate the path of mindfulness and compassion? Meditation practice. So with whatever lens we might want to look at this through, either the traditional Tibetan Buddhist lens, the Shambhala lens, even a Zen lens. The Zen master Suzuki Roshi once said, looking out at his students, all of you are perfect just as you are. And you could use a little improvement. We're okay, fundamentally okay, we're fundamentally perfect, and we could use a little improvement because we're a little messy. Can we hold both? Is this okay for us to hold both? I'm going to get into it a little bit more because it's not just me being messy and also okay. And it's not just Carlo being messy and okay and Allie being messy and okay. It's all of us. So we'll get there in a minute, don't worry. But I wanted to talk about this meditation thing because I'm into it these days. Meditation is becoming really quite trendy, more mainstream than it ever has been. I grew up in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition and started meditating at a very young age, and it was so weird and esoteric to tell people growing up that I meditated. Like, I don't think I was necessarily shoved into lockers because of that, but I don't think it helped either. But now it's cool, right? I'm a cool kids Buddhist. I was, now I'm the cool kids entering middle age guy. So what's changed over these years? I think part of it is the fact that there's so much science around meditation. Feels every week now there's this study coming out, right? Harvard, MIT, University of Wisconsin, Stanford, you name it. And they're all agreeing that these different types of meditation, either meditating on the breath like we were, meditating on a mantra like in the Vedic tradition, this sort of focus actually stems real change, physiological change, like actual increased gray matter in the hippocampus, actually more activity in the ACC. He says, clutching his head, clearly not knowing what parts of the brain go where. I am not a neuroscientist. I read the studies, and I think it's fascinating. And I can only rely on my subjective experience. So I understand that objectively, if you meditate a little bit over a period of time, say 8 weeks, you actually see these changes in the brain. What that means is that we would actually see more productivity. We'd be more efficient with our time and our energy. We would actually have a boosted immune system. We would have a normalized sleep. We would be more present. We would be less held by stress. I've often noticed that they say, oh, they're less stressed out. And it's like, I don't think they're less stressed out. Like, I don't think all of a sudden their like bosses are easier on them at work. I think they're less held by stress, right? Like, they get stressed out and they're like, oh, I can return to a point of relaxation quicker. I think that's what we're actually measuring. For me, in the subjective world of not understanding neuroscience, I would say being present with something as simple as the breath actually allows me to be present for all of these other wonderful aspects of my life, be it sitting here with all of you, and actually being here with you, as opposed to like mentally being in my inbox. Whether it's me spending time with my fiance and we're actually having dinner and actually catching up and connecting. Whether it's me being in a fight with my fiance and I'm actually deeply listening to her and hearing what's going on. Whether it's me holding a loved one's hand in the hospital. So, you know, meditation doesn't mean that our life is always good. Like, that's not basic goodness. But it means that we could show up for it and express our inherent goodness. That's what we're talking about. So life can still be messy and we can still show up and be there for it in a way that feels whole, complete, and good. Does that distinction make sense? Okay. So we're perfect just as you are. We can use a little improvement. How do we do it? Meditation. Meditation really does help us not only become more effective and productive and all these wonderful things. Don't get me wrong. I think it's great. But it also helps us with self-awareness. We start to notice how we're messy. We start to notice the ways that we have habitual patterns that act up and don't necessarily benefit us. And we say, maybe I should do something about it. This is in the Contentment in Everyday Life class that we offer here at the Shambhala Center. This is there's a whole class on discernment. One of the many qualities that stem from meditation. Discernment here being noticing which aspects of our life we might actually need to cultivate and which ones we might actually need to cut out a little bit, both mentally and in our actual everyday life. It's both. So it's very helpful in terms of self-awareness, noticing how we react, how we overreact, how we get stuck by strong emotions, all of it. So that we actually have, what we're doing in meditation is we're cultivating the ability to act skillfully. Because we are more present and more aware, we see a situation more clearly for what it is. And then as a result, we're more able to show up for others in ways that are meaningful and coming from a place of goodness as opposed to a place of messiness. So that's us. We're looking at our own state. But we look at our own state so that we actually show up in a helpful and a healthy and helpful way for others. This is where it starts to get interesting for me. This idea that it's not just us, it's everyone. You didn't come to the talk that says Lodro is a mess and Lodro is okay. Or Georgia is a mess and Georgia is okay. You came for everything is a mess and everything is okay. So let's talk it out. I mean, I don't necessarily have an interest in alienating anyone on a political spectrum. I don't think that's necessarily helpful for me here tonight. But I will say that the last year revealed a tremendous amount of messiness in our society. No matter who won on November 8th, we would have had to come to grips with the fact that bubbling beneath the surface of our society is incredible racism, Islamophobia, sexism, classism, and more. It's very messy, our society. It's extremely messy. I feel like the last time I was sitting here, it was shortly after the Pulse shooting, and gun control issues are very close to my heart. And I was feeling equally heartbroken at that time, just sort of confused and baffled, and all of these messy feelings around how did we end up here? And I continue to feel that on the societal level every single day. There are a lot of things that don't necessarily make sense and feel okay in a conventional way. A lot of things that don't actually feel good in a conventional sense. I think one of the things I get in trouble for is that when I give talks on society, I try to make the point that it's not just the people in this room that are basically good. It's everyone. Which means that Donald Trump is basically good. Barack Obama is basically good. Hillary Clinton is basically good. Rex Tillerson is basically good. And there's a lot of messiness. I have personal and my own meta practice people, even within that group, that I like, people that I don't like. I can definitely, on the relative level, acknowledge that, of course. But on an absolute level, I have to also say they possess the same seeds for awakening that I do. And I am confused, and I can also look at the fact that I might have to accept that they are confused and not close my heart off to them, which is very hard. I have no clear answers for what anyone who is feeling particularly heartbroken at this time should do. I think it's worth us discussing. I think it's worth us talking to our neighbors. For me, it means talking to my fiancé's family in Ashtabula, Ohio, who in my mind voted against their interests in many ways, and actually forging forms of connection and empathy so that we could better understand each other. It's one of the things that I'm doing. The Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh once said, "Understanding is the other name for love. If you can't understand, you can't love." And for those of us who feel like this is a time where we need to offer love and compassion, we have to come from a place of understanding others. Why is this at all related to what I was talking about before? If we don't understand ourselves, if we don't understand the ways that we get stuck, the ways that we are messy, the ways that we are confused, what hope do we have of understanding others? I'm a firm believer that with all of the science around meditation and all of the like backlash of people being like, if you just meditate, you're going to miss all the point of ethics, of Buddhism, and things like that. I think my counterpoint here would be, when we actually meditate and we understand our own messiness and our own suffering, we start to notice that in the people around us. Because we have more awareness, we say, oh, so-and-so is getting stuck by complete paranoia or complete jealousy or complete anger, just like me. I know what it's like when I get stuck by that messiness and that suffering. And in that moment, it's not, you're wrong and I'm right. It's my heart goes out to you because I understand how difficult that can be. It's a moment of understanding because we understand ourselves. Does that distinction make sense, that we would understand others in that way? It's one of many ways of doing it, of course. This is just one modality, this whole meditation shtick. But you showed up here, so I'm going to kick the dead horse and say you should try it. Where am I in these notes? Past Lodro and present Lodro are always at war. Yeah. So, okay, I'm throwing a lot of quotes at you, but this one is interesting to me. It's from Suzuki Roshi again, the great Zen master. He said, quote, "Our everyday life is in the realm of good and bad, the realm of duality, while Buddha nature is found in the realm of the absolute where there is no good and bad. There is a twofold reality. Our practice is to go beyond the realm of good and bad and to realize the absolute. It may be rather difficult to understand." Was that rather difficult to understand? Yes. Okay, good. We started with ourselves. Some would say it would be the foundational teachings. They're often emphasized by the school of elders, the Theravada schools. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Mahayana, greater vehicle schools, schools that really emphasize the compassion in being in the world. Not that the Theravada schools don't have a way of doing that, but there's a particular emphasis on the compassion tools in the Mahayana view. And within this, there's absolute and relative. And I used these terms a few minutes ago very loosely, so I want to define them. On an absolute level, we get into the idea that things may not be as solid and as real as we might have originally suspected. These are teachings that are often taught in our Fearlessness in Everyday Life class, which is a really wonderful one, where we go in depth as opposed to the finger painting I'm about to do. For example, what is this? Anyone? Glass of water? Okay. What if I put flowers in it? What would it be then? A vase. Okay, so it's not a glass of water anymore? Okay, there we go. So we're already, yes, now Suzuki Roshi is right. It is very difficult to understand. So this is it. It's the idea that things exist in the way that we perceive them. That our mind, in some sense, what was the old Shakespeare line? That there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So Suzuki Roshi here is not so far from that. The idea that we really solidify our reality into very fixed dualistic ways. These people are good, these people are bad. Never the two shall meet. There's no lines of gray here. I open my heart to the good people, I close my heart to the bad people. Where in fact, if you've ever been in the situation where you really highly conceptualize this bad person that you know at work, and then they moved in down the street from you, and you start commuting together and seeing each other every day, start to notice the different ways that they get stuck and the different ways that they're kind and compassionate to their family and all of it, you might all of a sudden say, oh, this is a really nice person, and want to befriend them. And all of a sudden, your old enemy is now your friend. And how is that possible? So the idea here is that on a personal, interpersonal, and even on a societal level, things are more fluid and ephemeral than we might have originally made them out to be. That they are not as tightly held as we might believe. And in that sense, there's extremely good news because there's great opportunities for the truth of impermanence and change in a good way. Tangentially, this book, Love Hurts, just came out a month ago, and one of the chapters shares a story where I really was quite in despair, and I felt, I'm never going to love again. So I called my friend, I was like, I just need you to tell me, and he gave me the best pep talk. And I wrote in here, if you feel that way, if you feel like I will never love again, you send me an email, and I included my email address, with the subject line, I will never love again, and you include your phone number, and I will call you, and I will tell you that you will. And now I'm making 3 of these fucking calls a day. I'm like, oh gosh, I hope it goes to voicemail. It's awkward if it doesn't go to voicemail. You know? And it's the idea that at some point, they're like, my worldview is so fixed that it's never going to change. And one of the things I always say to these people is that even the incredibly devastating and horribly hard emotional states that we may be experiencing, the good news of impermanence is that they change too. They shift and they morph, and they either heal in certain ways or they shift in ways that are a little bit less painful, and all of it. So if we are in despair about the messiness of our society, about our personal life, about any of it, the good news is that everything's impermanent. And if we think that everything is really going our way right now, the bad news is everything is impermanent. It's both. Aren't you guys glad you came on a Tuesday night? What a downer I am. So everything is messy, even on a societal level. And fundamentally, it's okay, because there is the potential for awakening. And even the things that we think are very, very bad might be ripe for deep societal revolutionary even change. So that's the absolute aspect, that things are more fluid than we might have suspected. And then there's the Buddha nature found in the realm of the absolute, as the Suzuki Roshi said. And our practice is to go beyond our conventional idea of good, bad, to actually realize our own potential for awakening, and the potential for the awakening of others. That's what he's saying here. Hopefully that's not as difficult to understand. An easier quote would be on the relative scale. So on the absolute level, we don't exist in the way that we think we do. Our friends don't exist in the way that we think I do. Our enemies don't exist in the way we think I do. It's much more fluid than that. And on a relative level, we do have to go to the party and see them. Like, you know, it's the weekend coming up, and you might see both friends and enemies at this gathering that you're going to. Or you might have to turn on the television and see that someone was elected that you don't get along with or even think might be a danger. So on the relative level, we still have to be here. It's not like we get into this nihilistic, nothing really matters, everything's impermanent and not real and completely ephemeral, emptiness is king. It's also like we got to go to work tomorrow. So what happens? From the Buddhist point of view, I think the Dalai Lama summed it up best when he said, "Our prime purpose in this life is to help others, and if you can't help them, at least don't hurt them." I think that's such a, like, a great aspiration for 2017, right? Like, if I can't help you, at least I'm not going to make this worse. I'm not going to hurt you. Maybe that's something that's good enough. But maybe we can show up and be helpful through the point and lens of understanding others so that we could offer love in a world that desperately needs it. So our path is balancing these, the absolute and the relative. In one sense, things are more empty and fluid than we might have originally suspected. On the other, it was just Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And in honor of that man, we also have to fight for justice and not necessarily make, not let certain things that we think are endangering civil rights normal. So it's both. On one hand, it's not as solid and real, and on the other, that doesn't mean that we lay down and just let our society change because we don't think we have a place in it or can't affect it. Because it's actually a little bit bigger than that. It's actually, once we get to the societal level, having worked with the acceptance of self, moving to the acceptance of others, we actually have a great ripple effect. And I often think about the wonderful speech that Robert Kennedy gave many years ago, where he says, like a stone thrown in a pool of water, that we don't always know where the ripples will go. So, as speaking as someone who has no answers, I do have faith that showing up and having open-hearted discussions, looking to the lens of self-acceptance, acceptance of others, and trying to form bridges of empathy and understanding, pursuing action that is based in our, Tibetan word would be ninje, noble heart. One could say our moral compass, however you would like to talk about it. The more we do that, the more that we actually have a ripple effect on the society. And it's actually, we don't know how far those ripples go. And we sort of have to hold out faith, hope, however we want to talk about it, that even though everything is messy, there are seeds for complete wholeness, complete goodness within each of us that could be awakened. I think we have a few minutes for reflections, questions. I would really love to hear what's on your mind.
I have either a very easy or a very complicated question for you.
Okay.
You keep referring to love. What is your definition of love? Mm-hmm. Because you've used it in several different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't agree with the whole concept of one will never love again and so on and so forth, because again, what is your definition of love?
Mm-hmm.
Is it attachment?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. It's either an easy question or difficult.
No, it's a very good question. So Sabine's saying, let's be clear about our terms here. Because let's be honest, I threw a bazillion out. I love that you went for the one, like, let's define love. That's good. Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, in his book Ruling Your World, it's perhaps the best Buddhist writing on love in my mind. It's chapter 12. It's called Letting Love Flow, and I highly recommend it. Because he talks about how love is based in this view of basic goodness, based in the view of Buddha nature and our inherent awakened state, it's inherent to who we are, that we are inherently lovable and loving, both. So when someone might email me and say, I will never love again, my job is to sort of disabuse them of that notion with a sense of kindness, right? I'm not going to be like, you jerk, of course you will read this book by Sakyong Mipham. I don't think they're going to do it. But if I could sort of gently prod them in the possibility that they would heal, that's good. Because for any of us that have offered our heart wholly and put it on the table and then had someone in our life, and it doesn't always have to be romantic by any means, it could be family, it could be a good friend, come through and smash it with a hammer, the first impulse we have is to scoop it up and seal ourselves so tightly and armor up and be like, I'm not going to do that again. Sakyong Nipam Rinpoche in this chapter says that this is, when we start to heal, we might actually get to the point where we're starting to love with that view of attachment, that we might want to box in our love and say, it looks like this. It looks like you always do the dishes, so I love you. And then when you don't do the dishes, I'm upset and my reality is shattered, right? What is this? I thought we had a deal here. In fact, the whole idea of letting love flow is that love is boundless. I think one of the interesting things that when I was writing the book Love Hurts, because it's all about the different types of heartbreak that are out there, not just a romantic thing by any means, but societal heartbreak. I met with people who gave their child up for adoption and then didn't know what happened 20 years later, people who were suffering from PTSD from 9/11, you name it. The interesting thing is that when they were talking about love, they would sometimes talk about it like they offered it to someone and someone walked away with it. When in fact, when someone walks away, the love is still there. It's just we might feel like there's a loss because the object of love is no longer there. Love is actually much more formless and boundless than I love you for this duration of time, and then the moment you walk away, it's done. Like, that's not how it works. It's much more fluid than that. So maybe I made your simple or complicated question even more complicated. But I think what we're talking about is innate to who we are, more boundless than we might suspect. We can offer it to an object, but it is not dependent on an object. Is that... Okay, great. That's a great question. I appreciate it.
Hi, Lodro. Recognizing everyone has a seed, Donald Trump has a seed of basic goodness. I totally get all that.
Okay,
but
cool.
But then he speaks and people like him speak, and I have to be like, oh, because I've meditated, I brought awareness to myself when I've been a jerk, so all people are jerks, so now I have... can extend that compassion to you, but it feels more like pity compassion, and then it turns quickly into wrathful compassion, which are two words I've learned through my Shambhala training, and I'm kind of stuck in between the two, and I feel like I'm just sort of using those as cover-ups for just feeling, I'm just angry, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and but, the nice thing is that you're probably in good company here, of being like, I'm angry and I don't know what to do. And sometimes the most devastating and yet true aspect, Debbie was using that word earlier, I loved that. Sometimes that's just what's going on. That's true. That we are angry and there isn't a simple thing that we do with that. That maybe we have to sit in the middle of that completely devastating experience and look it dead in the eyes and say, okay, I feel angry. And not necessarily feel like we need to exercise that part of our body or that part of our emotional content and landscape. We need to get rid of that anger, or we need to get rid of that angst, or get rid of that worry. Meditation is at its core an idea of accepting all of who we are. Right? I feel like you can't go to a talk with me without me going over my favorite Tibetan word. Would anyone like to guess what it is? Gom, exactly. Poor Adriana had to do like a long training with me. She's like every fucking week, Gom. Gom can be translated as meditation from the Tibetan language. It can also be translated as become familiar with or familiarization. The very idea that when we meditate, what we're doing is becoming familiar with all of it. So we become familiar with our compassion. We get familiar with the ways that we might want to shut down our compassion. We get familiar with our anger, not only at these individuals, but maybe even with ourself, because we feel like we should feel compassion, but we don't. You know, it goes on and on like that. But it's actually learning to get to know all of it. And at some point, ideally embrace and be kind and befriend ourselves for it. So we don't have to change who we are, because we're perfect just as we are. And the little bit of improvement is that we might need to get better at sitting with that and finding the skillful ways that we work with that. I don't, again, have some brilliant answer for what to do with a political situation that one may or may not enjoy and might actually find quite dangerous. I will say that one thing that I continue to reflect on is that even at the end of the day, I think Donald Trump wants his family to be safe. I want my family to be safe. And that's a point of compassion and connection for us. And maybe that's as far as I go today. And maybe I don't have to love him. And maybe I don't have to agree with him. And maybe I could even have a lot of conflicting emotions about him. But there's one seed of connection there. And that allows me to think, oh, maybe that's my way into not just having a theory about Donald Trump and basic goodness, but actually a realization of it. Does that make sense? That's how I'm working with it. And that's just one of many, many ways, I'm sure.
Hi, Lojra. So in your book, I'm piggybacking on Sabine's question about love. There, you quote the Sakyong Mipan Rinpoche on letting go, and he said that that love, letting go, is love with a lot of space around it, spaciousness around it. I feel like I've been trying to work with that letting go for a while now, but part of me, I feel like, still has this part that's grasping and wanting and the sense of attachment that I'm really trying to give space around, but it keeps welling back and coming back. I'm wondering if there's any way to kind of work with that more so the letting go gets easier.
Yeah, well, I think you just said it too, like the more we do it, the more if we have to let go of something, cut something out of our life, apply a discipline around something so that we see less of something or someone. It's a practice, it's a training, and it gradually does get easier. But I wanted to just briefly read the definition that I offered for heartbreak, for lack of better one, finding, like, I was looking, sitting there writing this book, I was like, all right, like, broken heart, heartbreak, where's that from? Like, there's references going back to the time of the Bible. Dictionary.com defines it as great sorrow, grief, or anguish. And I was like, that's a little surface level, isn't it? So here's my personal definition. Heartbreak, noun. The vast pain that we suffer in response to our expectations not being met in some way, a facet of reality as a human being. So I think it's a facet of who we are, that we are going to be disappointed because we have so many expectations for how things should look. So sometimes what we need to let go of is not necessarily always, I mean, sometimes it is a relationship to a person or a relationship to a thing, but a lot of times it's relationship to an idea. We have to let go of our own expectations because that seems to be what's holding us back. Is that helpful, Dahl? Without knowing the situation too much and making you publicly display your life, I would love to hear a little bit more about what this is like for you so I might be a bit more helpful.
Yes, it does have to do with a relationship that came to an end around August. I feel that I've tried to separate myself from the person, but I still feel like I generally still love the person, but I need to let go of that. Yeah. So I've tried to give it as much space as possible, but it still comes up in my mind a lot. No. I've tried very hard.
This strikes me as highly normal, for the record. Not that anyone has said anything abnormal tonight, but the idea that we are no longer with a human being that we have been with and have based a life around, it's exactly, it is piggybacking what Sabine was saying, this idea that just because the object of the love is no longer there doesn't mean that we don't think about this person, that we're not constantly reminded about this person, or that the love doesn't exist. The love is still very much there. It's like those cartoons where they run through the wall and there's like just the imprint of where of what they look like through the wall. It's like that only in our heart. Like that person like ran through us. It's like, oh, wait, there's this hole here where there was an object for that love, and now it's just formless love, which is a real bitch. It is. It's painful.
How do you contend with the loneliness that comes along with that? Because I feel like it's very much where I am right now.
Yeah. There were four questions. When people, I wrote this book in a very weird way, and I'm going to do an abbreviated version of this story, where I met with people over the course of a week in ABC Carpet and Home, which is just like down the block from here, really. It's this, if you don't know, it's like this giant store, and they were very generous and gave me space where I could meet with people privately for sessions where I literally would only ask four questions. Sometimes I wouldn't get through all four. Question number one, what is your experience of heartbreak? Which is vast. I mean, really, like, as I mentioned before, it's not necessarily always romantic heartbreak, although certainly sometimes it was. It's everything from, I was with this man for many, many years, and we were married, and it turns out he's gay. I look exactly like that victim of police brutality, exactly like her. Everything. And then having shared the story, the second question was always, how do you feel right now? Because sometimes actually moving away from the loneliness and isolation of our heartbreak, sharing it with another human being, ideally feeling heard and understood, shifts something in how we relate to our heartbreak and the stories that we talk about, and does allow us to let go a little bit better, if even for that day. Three, how do you take care of yourself in the midst of heartbreak? Funnily enough, every single time that I asked that question of someone, the first response was, I'll tell you the thing I do that I shouldn't do. Right? Well, I reach for the cookies and then I eat as many of them as I can. I have a drink. I go on Tinder. If I feel lonely, like I want to do something about it. It doesn't feel good. I need to move away from this. I'm going to distract myself from the strong emotion. Then I don't feel good about it after. And then they would move into all of the wonderful things that they would do to take care of themselves. Particularly around loneliness, it was stuff around spending time with friends, with family, with little beings like children, dogs, cats. Spending quality time with themselves, i.e. like going for a long walk, doing a yoga class. And then the fourth question was always, what could you do to take care of yourself today? In other words, I would make them like look me in the eyes and be like, okay, I'll do something, I swear. Because it's very cathartic and also very hard to talk about these situations, to talk about our heartbreak on a personal, interpersonal, and societal level. Because why the hell would anyone reach out to a complete stranger who wrote a book and say, here's my personal phone number, call me and tell me I will love again? It's because they feel lonely. Is because they feel isolated, and it's because they don't know if they are actually the only person that's ever felt this way. So I'll close out with a very short story from the time of the Buddha of this woman, Kisa Gotami. Kisa had a very rough upbringing, and she grew up in poverty, did not have much, she got married, was accepted into her family, her husband's family, but he was very unkind, they were very unkind. And at some point she had a boy, a child of her own, and it was the light of her life. And this child at a very young age grew ill and died. And she was devastated, and she walked through the streets yelling, please, someone provide this medicine for my child. My child is sick. And of course, everyone that saw her realized that the child was dead. Finally, someone said, if there's ever a human being that could help you, it would be the Buddha. You should go see the Buddha. So she went in search of this guy and found him in front of a large monastic following and said, please, she's holding her child, please give me medicine. Someone said that you would have the medicine for my child. The Buddha clearly saw the situation for what it was and said, I will give you the medicine you need. What I need you to do is to go get a mustard seed back in town. She got very excited. That's very easy to do. And she said, the mustard seed has to be from a family that has not known death. So she goes and she knocks on her neighbor's door, and this old man opens and she says, could I please have a mustard seed? He says, yeah, sure, okay, and goes and gets a mustard seed. She says, oh, I'm so sorry, I forgot to ask. No one here has died, right? Actually, my wife of many years just passed away last month. She said, I'm so sorry for your loss. And went to the next house, knocked on the door, and there was a young girl. And she said, could I please have a mustard seed? And they said, okay. She says, oh, and just to be safe, no one here has died, right? And the little girl gathered her siblings together, and they were all very tearful, and they said, "Our mother died just last year. It's just us now." And she said, "I'm so sorry." And she went to the next door and the next door and continued on in this way. And at some point she realized that she was not alone. She was not the only one to have known such suffering. That death actually comes to everyone and it touches us all. And at that point, having realized that, the truth that the Buddha tried to show her, she prepared a funeral for her son and went to pursue the monastic order, and was actually of great benefit to so many people because she had actually realized this truth and moved beyond her loneliness and isolation. When we feel heartbreak, we feel it's just us. When we feel great despair and devastation, we think we're alone. And that is not true. There are so many of us feeling it on any given day. So please do not be lonely.
I think that's what we're feeling right now with what's happening. I think that we're not just fearful, but mournful. Mm-hmm. That something has died, you know, that these steps towards, that we felt were being made towards a more accepting world as a beloved president and his wife leaves. I think that we're all in mourning, really. I am.
Yeah. I am. Right. I wouldn't necessarily assume that everyone is. I don't want to do that. But I feel that you on that. And I do think, looking at that definition of heartbreak, of like, oh, I expected that society was like this now. I thought we had made it to this point. And now my reality stepping in, the asshole that it is, and says, no. Your expectations don't mean anything to me. So could we move beyond our isolation and our loneliness, is my question, to the point that we might find connection and empathy, understanding, and see what we can do?
For myself, I feel that the idea of love or sadness or anger are not so fixed. And that just the idea of love... of the idea, I was talking to a friend yesterday about the idea, and I said, I'm not sure whether I'm using the right word because he's a writer, and I said, this idea of desire, and he said covetous, you know, coveting something, and that we tend to, for me, the exercise is always to love or to care, but not to sort of cling, because that openness that you were talking about in terms of the vastness of love closes down and becomes myopic. I think it's because it's easier to it's easier to understand, but then we're robbed of a lot of it. And I think it's the same thing with anger. You know, I'm angry about this situation, but I find in that anger I'm getting very fixed, and it creates a very easy answer. You know, I could just take this punk attitude that I have. But my friend basically told me, that's a lot of fun, but it's not, you should really be coming more from a place of peace. Mm. And it is fun to be angry, to stir up that punk, you know, middle finger mentality. It is, but it doesn't necessarily, it just covers up the mournful feeling. Mm. It makes it simpler, but it's not true, which is what you're talking about. What is true? What is true? That's not really true.
Yeah.
Because it's messier than that. It feels rawer than that, and that's not easy to deal with. It's not so fun.
Yeah. For anyone here who has the opportunity to do the Shambhala meditation that's often introduced, as opposed to the Shamatha meditation, it's two different things. The Shambhala meditation has this beautiful step in it where we're asked to just become genuine. That's actually like part of the meditation practice, where I say, oh, wait, check in. What are you? What's going on here? Become genuine. Like, basically, if we're going to be meditating, we have to be honest with ourselves. Can we be authentic? How am I feeling?
Do you find when you're genuine, does it open up that sense of fixedness, that it somehow provides space?
In my experience, it does. But in my experience, to go with the sort of dead horse kicking, it's a training, right? Like, we literally have to train and saying, oh, wait, I noticed this old friend of punk mentality. or this old friend of wanting to shut down, or this old friend of icing someone out and saying, wait, what's actually going on? Can I be authentic? Can I be genuine here with myself and see if there's something else that I need to look at? Because we are so messy. But the good news, friends, is that we are also okay. So thank you so much for coming. There is, I imagine there are carrots and tea. It's the old standard for 45 years now. Can't imagine we'd break now. Please continue to hang out and get to know one another and continue to connect. Thank you.
Thank you, Lodro. And thanks for listening, everybody. Hey, visit us at nmyadoptionbala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. Check out that 7-day retreat, February 20th. Maybe it seems far-fetched, but maybe not. I don't know. Look into it. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, favorite coping strategies. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City metropolitan area, come see these talks live, in person, every Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. There's community. There's food of a sort. And there's great talks. Later.